right. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Tech Can't Save Us, podcast by Literal Humans. I'm joined today by the wonderful Miloš Filinski, the founder of Luminous. Hi, Miloš.
Hey, great to be here.
Thanks for jumping on the pod. We really appreciate it. Miloš and I got connected through kind of the Tech for Good network here in the UK. Miloš, you're based in Scotland, is that right?
Yeah, I'm based just outside of Edinburgh.
Got it. Okay, so a little bit further north. We were just chatting about the light, how the light is slowly coming back as we're moving into summertime here, springtime here in the UK. Look at me jumping the gun. But yeah, it's been good to chat with you, Miloš, about, you know, all things tech for good in the UK and, you know, hopefully the beginning of a great friendship and partnership there. So.
Yep, likewise. Tech for good really needs good people here in the UK. So I'm excited to be speaking with you.
Yeah, it's wonderful. Well, thanks for having on. Well, let's jump in. You know, first of all, I'm sure the amazing name Luminous, it's awesome. It's very evocative. So like, tell us about Luminous, how the idea came about and what's unique about it.
Right. So the name actually came way before the company. It's been about a year since I've wanted to start something called Luminous. I didn't quite know what that was, but I liked the name and I had the domain ready and everything. So that was coming. But as I left my startup job where I was running design, I didn't quite know what to do. So I jumped in to work with clients right away. And it turned out that my kind of quite unique skill is helping people achieve product market fit. And at the time, I didn't really have a way to articulate it, so I didn't even know that that's what I was doing. But as I was working, as I was starting to see what brings clients together around me and what are the common things that I help them with, this idea of a startup success studio really started clarifying. So you have product design studios, you have startup studios, and what was really I think unique about what I do is helping people succeed with products. So Luminous is really, you could call it a design studio, you could call it a product design studio, you could call it mostly a startup studio, but really it's we're working across all of these and helping early stage tech startups achieve product market fit through design.
It sounds like you clearly saw a need for product design services, but also kind of a bit of like business consulting services and like, you know, sort of helping founders like get some strong business sense and product market fit. Say more about that.
Yeah. So very rarely I've seen that my clients come to me with a very specific ask of here's what we want to build. We have great product market fit. We just need nice design on top of it. It's more likely that they know they need design, but they also just have an idea for a product. So it's really about helping them formulate what that idea should be in reality. And it's often done through design, but it's design is not the deliverable. It's the process that matters more. And it's helping them think through these things and helping them answer those difficult business questions and difficult user questions that are difficult to answer if you don't have the skills of design often, or of just generally the product thinking type skills.
That seems like an incredibly valuable like process, but also just service to offer to clients. Like, are there any like examples out there that you could think of in terms of like how you've seen that work really well for your clients?
Yeah, so one example is the work I did with Rapid Dream. So it's one of the companies that I have a kind of part-time CPO role at. And the founder came to me with, after releasing their alpha, they didn't really get a good response. So they spent almost a year working on it. They've done a lot of great technical work, but they didn't really think during that time to check in with the users. What is it that they would like, or is it something they'd actually pay for? So they didn't really use that process and they didn't really have the skills to have that kind of a process. So we worked with Rapid Dream, I coached the founder on how to interview people. We went through the interviews, we went through the conclusions he drew, and we slowly shaped the new product. During that time, we've pivoted and narrowed down what the product does about 6 times. So it's not been a direct route. It's been very much experimental and it will be different depending on everyone. But the founder actually has very strong product skills. They were just needing to be kind of brought out Because as you're a founder, you have so many responsibilities that it's maybe hard to focus on one specific thing. So a lot of what I do is I also help provide that at the right stage so that you have a block of time where you just focus on product market fit, and then maybe you're done for now. Maybe there's a time where you just build or a time where you just improve, but it's important to carve out that time specifically for finding strong product market fit.
It sounds like an element of the work you do is like coaching. So like coaching founders, maybe even coaching like teams, product teams, perhaps.
Yeah. Which is why it's been so difficult to describe what I do, because I've not planned any single thing. I've not planned any element of it at all. It all makes sense in retrospect. So the best kind of insight I have is looking back at what I've done and trying to describe it. But I have usually no idea what I'm getting into or how it's going to work out. So it's really, I only know the next step often, which is quite hard to plan your business. And it may be that the founders themselves find themselves in that position. So it's good to work with someone from the outside who can see these things. But it doesn't mean I see these things for myself, which is funny.
It also kind of boils down to that core thing when you are offering a service, which is like people are hiring you for you. Like they're hiring you for your brain, your thoughtfulness, yeah, your ability to connect to them emotionally on some level. And that's just, you know, they hire you because they trust you. So that's seems like you're getting at that with the way your services are structured to some extent. So and you're growing. So there's the proof, there's the evidence.
So. Yeah. Although scaling that part specifically has been challenging, as you can't scale yourself so much.
Are you saying humans don't scale? Is that what you're saying? Individual humans? Okay. So to that very point, you're working as like a part-time CPO across like a few different, you know, startups. Like tell us about that experience and what you're learning from it. Hopefully maybe what they're learning from you.
Yeah. So I've really found that early stage startups don't need a full-time product role often enough. The founders themselves have enough of a product vision that they can carry out most of these product things. So what they often need is more of an advisor. And it's quite difficult for small startups to hire someone really senior full time, as it's likely that the salary of that person would be the size of their funding that they got. It's a lot more efficient for them to get part-time help and advice that they need at that specific moment, and maybe helping them structure internal processes, getting advice on how to hire or support with hiring the right people in product, and also helping them structure the roadmap. So it's really been these kinds of things where it's something I see is missing and I can add it, but it's not a packaged service, it's not just a design service as well. It's more that I sit with these teams and look at what's missing, and I add specific bits that I think would make the most impact, and try to delegate to the team as much as possible as well.
Talk to us about mentorship. Like what do you see, like people being under mentored and not mentored enough, or do you see people being over mentored and they're just sort of confused by all the different advice that they're getting? If you had to choose, which is the bigger problem that you've seen?
Right. So it could be both. I think it will really depend on the individual that's the founder and on their personality type, because a lot of people will surround themselves with people smarter than themselves and listen to them. But often the signals they get back are confusing. So I have clients that are in that position where the boards are probably too strong and the people are too senior and there's too many voices and it's impossible to settle on a vision or say, make the executives agree on what kind of exit they would actually like so they can even create a strategy. And the opposite is also true as well, where in those situations, the founders typically don't have networks good enough. So they're either a first-time founder or they're from a minority background often. And that makes it more difficult to get to the right kinds of people that can give the right kinds of advice. So these people typically don't get enough.
Yeah. I've seen both as well. And I think like the thing I'm focused on lately is like seeing a lot more over mentorship. you know, like just people with like, you know, they're sort of razzled and dazzled by all the, like you said, the very high tier folks that they've got on board as advisors or investors or board members. And they're not as well grounded in themselves in terms of how they're going to receive that, you know, that advice and that guidance. So they're just sort of spinning in all different directions with all these different, you know, advisors. So, and also I think there's like a, there's an ego thing there too. I think like if you're people like having like important advisors that way, because it makes them feel important, you know? So,
yeah. And I would even say that it's the same with internet. Like it's so easy to get five kinds of great advice on one topic. The thing is all five of them are to an extent valid. You just need to know, you just need to be able to discern what is the right advice at this moment, or, and also be kind of confident enough that you can say no to four things and just say yes to one, which is difficult on a personal level as well to founders, is ability to say no and ability to focus and commit.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, strategy is like, so much of strategy is understanding what to say no to, you know? And like, I've had clients in the past literally say out loud through their mouths, using their tongues and everything, like, you know, I don't want to have a strategy. I just want to like throw stuff at the wall and see what sticks. And I'm just kind of like, wow, you're in the wrong. Like this is not for you, you know, like sort of.
I think it's an interesting balance because you have deferring commitment, I think is important in areas where you don't know about, when you don't know too much about the market, for example, or too much about the product and how it's going to pan out. You want to defer big decisions as long as possible so you can get the most information. But at the same time, you can't prioritize five things at once. Typically, I ask teams and founders to just set three questions or three goals. Because even that is too much. But if I ask for one, that's almost impossible to get these days. They would much rather give me 20. But if they carried on doing work for 20 different priorities, they never get anywhere. So I think that tension and that balance is something you really need to manage as a founder, is how do you prioritize the important things, but also how do you test out many different options?
And lots of empathy for first-time founders. I mean, I consider myself a first-time founder twice over now. And like, you've really got to transform yourself while you're trying to transform your business. And like, that's really hard. It's like deeply personal work. So
it takes a lot of commitment as well, which is, I think specifically that's the link to purpose-driven startups that I find exciting, is that when a founder is personally invested in a vision, that's what makes this transformation possible for an entrepreneur.
Absolutely. So yeah, what is that for you? Like, what is the through line? And maybe you already mentioned it in terms of purpose-driven, but what's the through line that connects all the different ventures that you work on right now?
Yeah, so when I worked in startups before, and I worked with different startups, there was a growing sense of unease over the years about the kinds of things we're doing and the kinds of practices that we're employing and how we use data, and also like what kind of impact do we have when we have 1.5 million customers and none of us really know what we're doing, but we have a lot of impact on a lot of people's lives and we don't really think about it, what kind of responsibility it is. Like I think with product, because it's so abstracted and you can have your bit of code and your app store icon and it's all neatly packaged and that's your business, but actually is used by millions of people every day. And it fits in with their lives and it impacts how they think and it impacts how they act and how they interact with each other. So it's really hard to see the impact, is where I'm getting to. And we have the kind of impact we prioritize, which means we prioritize growth and we prioritize attention these days in tech businesses. So by default, we will exploit attention and we will exploit mental well-being of people almost as a default without thinking. So kind of seeing that and understanding that as I worked with many different companies over the years, I've really wanted to do something to counter that. Hence my interest in tech for good, but also interest in purpose-driven companies, where if you build that purpose right into how you build your product, it's then possible to not only mitigate that negative impact, but also create positive impact.
To that point, like, so one of the things we try to do on the pod is like define tech for good. And I feel like you're helping us here with this idea that tech for good ideally is it's intentional. Like it's you start from the beginning with purpose or a specific purpose in mind. Have you seen any successful ventures kind of back into their purpose? Like they've built something and then they've kind of, okay, we need to backtrack and graft purpose on, or have you only seen it work where it's like part of the agenda from the beginning?
There is so much work that goes into building a purpose-driven company that if that happens, I think it's very rare. It might happen if you appoint a different founder or a different CEO, for example, when a company is going through a transition, and then they start restructuring the company in accordance to purpose. I like to think that technology is just an accelerator to intention. Whatever intention you start with, that's what you're going to accelerate. If you accelerate exploiting attention and you accelerate habit forming for exploiting attention and you accelerate growth, you can't suddenly switch that into purpose, because it's deeply ingrained. You almost would have to build a new product, which is what companies do when they go through that transition. But it's a massive undertaking.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, I like that phrase too, that technology is an accelerant for intention. You know, it gets you to the end result, the impact of that intention faster. That's really well said. Well, I mean, you talked about, you know, your company and sort of like the growing pains and trying to like scale yourself. It sounds like you've pivoted and now you're bringing on a co-founder. You know, I feel like that's something that a lot of tech founders, tech for good founders go through. So yeah, tell us about that experience. What's it been like onboarding a co-founder? You know, how are your skills complementary? And yeah, why'd you do it? What do you think it'll lead to?
Right. Yeah. So recently I have started working with someone who's become a co-founder. And it's how it's really came about was when you're a sole founder, you end up being responsible for everything. So you're responsible for developing the product or the service, for delivering it, for building relationships with customers, for market research, for company strategy, for everything. And if you have advisors, you will get advice on these specific things, but it's still your accountability to run with these things. So my natural strength is making, and is especially, I think, delivering this kind of consulting work where I can be in the moment with the customer and we chat and suddenly I see something that will help them a lot and I can contribute that and make that happen in the moment. So I've started working with someone that really knows the business development side of things, and she's grown and run many businesses before, and she also knows specifically the kind of work I do and how to package it, or how to extract it from me and translate it into something I could teach people. So it's really a perfect combination where together we are much better rounded and we can build a bigger company much faster. And even start thinking about things that wouldn't be possible for me. Because how I've seen things going forward before is I can quite easily teach design and manage design work with external designers or even hire designers in-house. But it would be much more difficult for me to know how to scale this thinking work and this consulting work around product market fit. Whereas with her, I've already started looking for consultants almost on day one. But she said we'll need them in a few months. So perfect. Bring it on.
That's great. I mean, it's great to find someone who's got, you know, the sort of like sales and business development sense, but then also I feel like this is such a key for founders, is like having a team that can sort of extract your vision and your, you know, kind of download your brain and then operationalize it. Like that's such a key skill, like a co-founder or even an operational team. So that's great. Congratulations.
Yeah. And a phrase that I love that my branding friend used was that you can't read the label from inside of the bottle. So So it's, I think every founder finds themselves in that position where they know where they're going, but they really only see that, just that next step. And someone standing kind of on the sideline and looking at them can see all of that without even having the specific expertise. So it's really useful to have that kind of person.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, that's good. Well, I mean, so that sort of leads me to the next question of like, you're working with all these different founders and they're inside the bottle. They can't necessarily see the, you know, the way they're being perceived outwardly, but like across the board, what have you seen as like the biggest challenge, you know, in terms of product development and helping startups achieve product market fit? Like, what is there one thing that you keep running into that's like, this is the big obstacle for them?
It's a good hard question. There's a few main things. One is that there is a lot of knowledge out there and it's hard to discern what is the right thing to do at any given specific moment. So should you build a prototype now or should you speak to customers as an example, or should you build a kind of learning prototype where you just fake everything and extract the learning, or should you actually start building a product is another question, because you will get different results with each one. So it's one, I think it's hard to know what is the best thing to do. And it's maybe impossible to know what is the best thing to do, but speaking with someone like me can give you at least a pretty precise perspective on what might be the best thing. I think the second thing is, on top of this first one, is you will start convincing yourself as a founder that you're doing the right thing, regardless of whether it is the right thing or not. So you will start to justify why you've done something that you've done. And recently I've been speaking to a startup that uses the concept of a North Star metric to drive everything in their team. So it's a single metric that you use to measure the success of the product. So an example would be daily active users for Facebook. The more daily active users Facebook has, the better Facebook does. And every product team at Facebook will have that one metric. So whether they make a change or not, or build a feature or not, it all drives toward bringing that metric up. So I've been speaking to a founder about this concept, and I'm pretty sure they have the wrong metric.
The wrong metric for their North Star metric.
Yeah. So I'm pretty sure, yeah. So every product project they have drives towards the wrong thing, which leads them slightly astray from product market fit. But they have a lot of good reasons why it's that metric. It's well justified, and it's hard to show that it might be the wrong metric.
So are you, help me understand your process. Are you coming in and saying, look, here's the wrong metric for your North Star metric. Here's a few reasons why. And I'm proposing a different North Star metric. Here's a few reasons why. Like, is that your process, or how does it look?
Yeah, it might be that as an example. It will depend on the model of engagement and how long we're looking to work together. But that would be one of the key things. If you got that far and you have a North Star metric where you actually measure and you have a product that you measure and then feedback and improve, that would be one of the core things we work from, is a North Star metric and what it is and what it should be. But that's speaking a bit to the change that we spoke about before, which is how do you turn a growth-obsessed company into a purpose-driven company? Is how do you turn... That's a smaller example of that, which is how do you make a change so fundamental? You can already see, like I can really feel the resistance in every client that I speak, and it's all well justified and it's all well defended as to why it's that specific metric. So a lot of it is about pushing people to question these things and creating an environment where it's safe as well to question these things.
And also it seems like a big part of it is like just having a process in place to ground your certainty. That seems really key. Like it's like, yeah, at some point you're going to need to be certain about your strategy and execute it and give it some time to be effective. But like you should also be flexible enough to revisit it based on the data and sort of, you know, yeah.
So that I would say that's actually the third thing is having a clear process. And I think maybe even more importantly, a clear person responsible for that process. So it defaults to the founder, as I'm sure you've experienced yourself. But even then, I typically recommend to almost create it as a separate job description. So you're not operating as the CEO, but you're operating maybe as a head of product or operating as the product owner, and almost have like an internal mini conversation with yourself as a CEO and as a product owner. So you can simulate a little bit, how would it be if that was another person?
That's a cool tool to have, like in your sort of, and a cool arrow for your quiver is sort of, let me simulate this process. How does this feel? You know, try it out rather than just like assuming, okay, what I've chosen is right. You know, that's,
yeah. And then as soon as you start growing it, you'll be ready to pass that on to someone and train them how to be a product owner at your company, as opposed to them coming in with their experience of how being a product owner is on another company or starting from nothing and kind of trying to understand you and extract what they think is best and then turn it into a product role.
Cool. I mean, pulling us back a little bit broader, I mean, we touched on, you know, purpose-driven companies and things like that. I'm sure you've seen many of them and the different problems they're trying to solve. But in your view, what's a problem that tech can't solve for us?
I think tech can't transform us into better people. Like, it's still work we have to do. I think a lot, if you look at the challenges we have right now, challenges with social justice, but also climate and generally just how we organize ourselves as people and how economy functions and everything. These are challenges where solutions lie in us becoming better people. Like on average, if you measured how decent people are, we have to raise the scale. And how discerning and how tolerant and how aware. And technology can't do it for us. Technology can maybe accelerate that. That can bring us closer, but it's really down to us to make that choice and like down to every individual to either stay how you are or change your mind about something. And it's not going to be easier with technology. I think it's going to be just as difficult as it is now and as it always was.
Yeah, sort of looping back to your phrase about technology being an accelerant of intention. It seems like maybe the best we could hope for is that new technologies create an environment around people that, like you said, accelerates their change or their decision. Arguably, it's like, you know, people's decisions aren't just from their heads, like they're products of lots of stimuli to become a better person. But it sounds like you're saying that like that ultimate final decision needs to be made by the person and the tech can't make that for them. Is that right?
That's, I would say so. And of course, it's an infinitely complex topic. And having an environment that creates that kind of or facilitates that kind of change over time will mean that certain conversations disappear. Like racism right now is still a thing. But there may be a day where it isn't. And when people by default just wonder why there ever was racism. So it will actually be quite difficult to be racist. Whereas now, if you grow up in an area or in an environment where everyone is in some way racist, whether they know it or not, it's actually quite difficult not to be for some people. And just they just don't have access to not be that. And that change, that transformation feels difficult. And it's the same with every other thing. If you've driven petrol cars that burn a lot of fuel, and you depend on them, and you're never given any other way of transport a thought, it will be weird to start taking a bus or to cycle or to buy an electric car. But if everyone has electric cars around you, it's going to be easier.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, how does the tech get us to a point that it's just like an entire paradigm shift, you know? Yeah. And it's like the thing that the tech was built to help us with is no longer, the problem is no longer in existence. You know, that's super interesting.
So maybe, I guess what I'm getting to is that the choice itself will still be down to the people, but technology can help us build an environment where that choice is an easier one to make.
Yeah. I mean, I really do think that that's like so much of what it's all about is like the just creating a choice set around people that they can choose. And I think this bears itself out in the research. I mean, there's been research, like you look at reading a book by Carl Hart, who's like a leading drug researcher. And he talks about, you know, he would give cash vouchers to crack cocaine users and, you know, just scaled up the cash vouchers and found that it was less about biological addiction to crack and more about just having better choices and an environment with better choices, and pretty groundbreaking stuff, and really sort of questions the idea of like free will as it relates to like environmental stimuli and things like that. And, I think Sam Harris has some stuff about this. I think he's got a book about free will out there now, but, yeah, super interesting to see where that takes us, you know, the tech.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, along those lines, like we talk about tech for good, but we also talk about tech for bad as well on the podcast. So, this is your chance to name and shame a little bit. So like what's like the evilest application of tech that you've seen out there?
I don't know how to answer this. I think, I don't know if there's any company that's specifically evil, that's set out to do evil. I think
here's the thing, though: it's not about intention; it's about impact, right? Yeah. So, like, what is the evilest tech impact, I guess, you've seen in terms of a product?
It's a mixed bag, but I would say overall, social media, especially like how it's made us start to compare ourselves to each other. And our lives to each other's lives, as opposed to just enjoy communication and being closer to people. But I, at the same time, it's not like product teams at Facebook and Instagram and Twitter set out to make people compare each other and just build these habit loops that make people anxious and depressed. It's a consequence that they've realized they had after the fact, but it's also one that's so, like, it's the first time we've done it at that scale, so there's no way they could know.
It does speak to intention, though, right? Because like what you said earlier, I think was powerful, like we've landed on these apps being used for people to compare themselves, and like that was sort of the intention in the beginning, right? Facebook was a product to compare how hot people were on college campuses, and like here we are you know, like almost two decades later, comparing each other. And that's, you know, baked in from the beginning. So
that's quite strange how that snuck in and stuck at the very core of the product all the way from the beginning. Yeah, at the same time, there's no point in vilifying. I think people at Facebook are all good people and they mean well. It's also a really difficult problem right now you're trying to solve. It's not like they can shut down Facebook because it's doing some bad, even though that may be the most moral thing to do in someone's eyes. They're still a company and they have stakeholders. And
there is this interesting thing, though, about how they've become, like, you know, they're like utilities. Like, we expect them to run and to operate in a certain way. And that was sort of never the, like, Facebook is a company. Who says they can't shut down tomorrow? You know what I mean? Like, the board could shut them down tomorrow, but like, we have this idea that they're now this public commons. And it's like, you know, and that people are entitled to like certain rights on them, which is like, it's fascinating. Like, but I don't know if that's the case in terms of the legal or even moral sort of framework. I don't know. I mean, it's super interesting because
a lot of these questions we're answering for the first time. So there's really no precedent, and the answers will also depend on who asks them. So the EU will have a different answer than the US Senate when it comes to privacy and data rights and many other things.
So yeah, I mean, okay, so to that point, like if you were starting something new with intention today, yeah, what would your new tech product be, and yeah, what problems would it solve and for whom?
I have two kind of areas I've been thinking about. And I'm not starting a tech product, just so you know, but where Luminous is going, there might be a point in a few years where we start doing that, where one of the things we do are our own products. One is the area of personal knowledge management. So Notion is a good example of a tool that kind of aims to do that. And Roam as well, Evernote used to be a good example of a tool that kind of tries to do that. But there is this, I see technology as being able to help us organize our knowledge, where it's smarter and more efficient than paper. And it's, I think there's potential that we could offload a lot of the things we know and structure our knowledge in a way that helps us think better and be more efficient and be more effective. And especially as we start linking that knowledge with other people, which is, I think, why tools like Notion are so popular, where you can start structuring your knowledge and you can start making processes and bring people into them. And suddenly this thing that was in your head grows beyond your head. And there's a team of people relying on a process that you created. And that was really a lot more difficult before Notion. So I'm wondering, what is the step up from that? Like, if that was a lot more seamless and a lot more manual and also kind of uncharted right now, because there aren't any Notion best practices or second brain best practices, I guess.
There's starting to be like a community that's cropping up around Notion. I feel like that's like, I'm probably going to butcher the name, but I think like, yeah, I think it's pronounced, no, K-H-E is the first name and then H-Y is the surname. I know him.
I also don't know how you pronounce his name, but I know him.
Okay.
I've seen his videos on Notion. So I think that's the start of a scene that helps us kind of chart a map around what's possible in that space. But also exciting for me is how we can build tools that build on that and expand that. And Roam is a good example of a kind of knowledge tool that's great for when you're building a book or when you're extracting knowledge out of someone or you're structuring research for really complicated things. But how do you actually bring that on to someone normal, someone that isn't a huge geek, and help them think better every day? That to me is really exciting. And the second one is around habit formation and around, especially now with COVID, I've been thinking about it a lot, is how do you stay close to people around meaningful things? So content on social media is often kind of in the moment relevant, but not really important. Yeah, maybe something like, how do you build habits and find support with the right kinds of people? And maybe also even bridge distances, especially now with COVID. Like if I have a resolution to meditate every day, what about the friend I meditated with a year ago? Maybe we can start a small kind of thing together where we know when each of us meditates and it kind of organically brings us close again.
I think it's happening. Like, I think it's happening in like chat groups, for example, because there's just like, again, that human need to like connect with others and to grow and to, you know, understand your growth through the lens of how other people are growing as well. But I think there's going to be like an evolution of that where it's like, okay, this is for chatting, but this is actually for like growing and learning with other people. So
interesting. So that's similar to the knowledge management question, where right now we're in the kind of place where a company goes, here's all the tools you can use to structure knowledge. And you kind of figure out how to do it and you get somewhere and you start doing it. Where it's similar with habits and chat, where you have a tool to communicate with people and they start chatting and for the purpose of growing together, but you don't have maybe a specific tool to do that.
Yeah, it's interesting. Well, maybe you've gotten to this already. I mean, you're sort of pointing the arrow forward, but like, what's your prediction for the tech for good space in 2021 and beyond? What do you see happening there? Is it around knowledge management or habit formation, or is it something else?
I think there's a lot of work to be done around building good networks and building social capital now with everyone being remote, and maintaining and building like supportive organic networks. So habits are a part of that, of course, but there's a bigger question of even at the workplace, how do you retain knowledge now, or how do you transfer knowledge? Other than schedule a Zoom meeting with someone. There's so many areas. There's a lot of social change and social innovation. There's a lot of good things happening around carbon footprints and just living better as a consumer. So any of these could become a bigger trend.
Well, that's a good note to end on. I think really appreciate your time, Milos. This has been awesome. Milos Filinski from Luminous, everyone. And Milos, where can everyone find you and Luminous on the interwebs?
So on the interwebs, we're lumi.design. So simple to remember. I'm Milos Filinski at all the social media, which I don't really use too much. So you can find an account, but I don't know if you'll find me. And all the contact details are on Lumi Design.
And Luminous has a great website. We're like super jealous of it. We're trying to copy it. So definitely check them out. We'll include the the links in the episode description as well. And yeah, Milos, it's been awesome to have you on. Awesome to connect. I wish you the best of luck with, you know, as you're growing Luminous and onboarding a new co-founder. And it's been a great conversation. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Bye now.